Hello, and welcome to Cutting the Curd, your bi-weekly dairy dispatch sponsored by TechServe. We're on Heritage Radio Network, www.heritageradionetwork.com. And our producers today are Nat Wiener and Jack Inslee. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby, and my guest co-host for today's talk is Heather Box, who, in addition to being one of my best friends, is a political guru, voter rights advocate, and contributor to the Huffington Post. Thanks for being on the show, Heather.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined in the studio today by Ann Mendelsohn, famous Ann Mendelsohn, who authored a book entitled Milk, The Surprising Story of Milk Through the Ages. Now, there are a few things of more political importance today than farming. However, we tend to hear very little about our country's farmscape beyond a few main commodity foods. Milk has been in the news a lot lately, as farmers from Maine to California face falling milk prices and a slow economy. We're going to talk a bit today about how milk came to be such a huge force in global markets, but also how humans and dairy animals have co-evolved over the millennia. Anne's book, Milk, The Surprising Story of Milk Through the Ages, is really multifaceted. In addition to being a wonderful treasure trove of milk-based recipes from all around the world, it's a fascinating chronicle of how humans have used milk through the ages. The funny thing is, and I learned this from Anne's book, up until quite recently, fluid milk as we know it today was never a major part of most people's diets. Ms. Mendelsohn's book illustrates how milk has evolved to be the commodity that it is today, and the changes that we, the cows, and the dairy industry at large have undergone in the past few centuries. Thanks for being with us today on Heritage Radio Network, Anne.
Thanks for having me.
First things first, a little intro. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write a book about milk?
Well, I'm not sure how I came to write a book about milk either, except that I grew up in a part of this country where there used to be a lot of cows. There used to be a lot of little mixed farms, including a dairy component. Guys would have some apple trees, they would have some pigs, they would have some chickens, they would grow some tomatoes, they would have some cows and milk them. And a landscape with farms like that is a wonderful place to grow up in. Needless to say, it's all gone now.
Can I ask where that was?
It was in southeastern Pennsylvania, Montgomery County, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And it was at one time pretty heavily Mennonite, but by the time I was growing up there, it was starting to turn into suburbia, and now it's just sort of wall-to-wall, chain drugstores and little strip malls and hardly anything left of the farms.
Okay. And so when you were young, would you visit those farms and sort of, partake of the milk and other stuff that was being produced there? Was that...
Well, we lived right down the road, about an eighth of a mile from Garrett Kaiser's farm. And I remember trying to milk Mr. Kaiser's cows. And I remember not getting very far. And I also remember the farm being auctioned off when I was like maybe 10 or 11. And it was turned into like a little specialty place where they raised peacocks and ornamental pheasants, anything but working animals. And that was kind of interesting growing up next to all these peacocks yelling, but I preferred listening to the cows.
Now, I remember, and we were talking a bit before the show, and you said that just as much as you love the the flavor of milk and milk as an ingredient in cooking, you love the animals, which I can certainly identify with. I love, being a cheesemonger, I love cows, sheep, and goats. But there is something very special about cows. They're kind of like noble animals in a way.
I like them all. But to me, cows have beautiful faces. And cows look like majestic animals. They have that. You can see why people worshipped them at one time.
So that's an interesting thing, because in your book you include recipes from all across the world, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how different cultures use milk and milk products. And I don't know if you noticed any interesting trends as far as if cows were revered in one country or one culture versus another, how that played into their use of dairy.
I'm not sure whether it does or not. There are an awful lot of cultures where nobody ever thought of drinking milk. Parts of Southeast Asia, for example, South America, North America, before Columbus, nobody ever thought of drinking another animal's milk, which is a very strange thing to do when you stop to consider it. Here's this secretion of another critter, and we people consume that secretion. There isn't any other animal that does this. It's really a curious fact when you stop to consider it. But cows were probably not domesticated as soon as goats and sheep, which were smaller, they were easier to handle without getting killed. And cattle are very fierce animals, or used to be before they were bred to be pretty docile. So we're not dealing with the same kind of animals as our Ice Age ancestors, or people back in 8,000 BC or whenever they first got the idea. Goats and sheep were domesticated first. They're an easier size to tangle with, and the milk has an interesting quality all in itself without anything being done to it. There's a characteristic taste of goat's milk and even more of sheep's milk because it's concentrated. Cow's milk is blander. There's less of a flavor that you can put a name to. It's just a more neutral kind of a milk. So people in these regions where the animals were first domesticated, these are very hot regions, this is the Middle East, Turkey, what is now Iran and Iraq, these places have blistering hot summers. Mm-hmm. And so the time when the animals are giving the most milk, because they would give birth seasonally in the spring, that time is exactly when the milk goes sour most quickly once it's taken from the animal. So you have like instant yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have fresh milk that's going to just stay fresh forever because nobody had invented refrigerators. You have milk that wants to turn into something else almost as soon as it leaves the cow or the goat or the sheep or whatever.
So you would say yogurt would sort of be the sort of primordial milk food that everybody consumed.
Yes, yes, definitely.
That's really interesting. Well, when we come back, we're going to take a quick break in a minute, but when we come back, it would be really interesting to hear then how we moved from, trying to keep milk from going sour, or, from using soured milk, as a food, be it yogurt or buttermilk or, cheese or anything else, how we went from that to starting to drink fresh milk, which I found to be one of the most compelling parts of your book. So I think we're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the rise of drinking milk. Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. This is Cutting the Curd. with Anne Saxelby and Anne Mendelson and Heather Box. We're here today talking with Anne Mendelson about her book, Milk, The Surprising Story of Milk Throughout the Ages. And we'd like to thank our sponsor, TechServe, for providing support for this wonderful radio network. So, Anne, how did we go from being yogurt eaters to milk drinkers?
Well, there's always been fresh milk because that's how it comes out of the cow. So obviously somebody experimented first with, they managed to subdue a nanny goat. One guy said, okay, Joe, you take the front end, I'll take the back end. And they got her down and managed to yank on a teat long enough to figure out that this stuff that was coming out of it was okay. It might be useful for food. Although it did go sour once they had gotten around to doing the thing more systematically. And the idea in those climates, you know, Turkey in midsummer, Iraq, Iran, the idea was not, okay, we're going to figure out how to keep milk fresh, because that would have been futile. But when milking got to colder climates, when it got to northern Europe, the eastern parts, you know, like northern Russia, northwestern Europe, then there was more there were cooler temperatures, there was a little more window for keeping the milk fresh longer. Still, it would go sour, maybe in a day instead of a few hours, but it would go sour until refrigeration was developed, and which didn't happen until the middle 19th century.
Okay. Okay.
Before then, you were really fighting a battle to get the milk to consumers in a fresh, unsoured state. The only way you could do it in cities was to have the animals in the city.
Well, that's a really interesting thing. I definitely want to talk about milk in New York City specifically, because I know that it's really fascinating. But we have a caller on the line who has a question, I'm assuming.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, mm-hmm. I can.
Great. I was wondering why, of all the types of milk that people drink, in the States, in Europe, they drink buffalo milk, but we don't drink buffalo milk here at all. And is there a good explanation for that, or?
Not really. The explanation is just that buffaloes were a kind of a hard animal to raise outside the subtropics or tropics until pretty recently. They got as far as Italy, the Po Valley, where mozzarella cheese from buffalo milk has been just famous for a long time. But the buffaloes, they really need water. They need more access to shade. They're a harder animal to take care of. Although there is a buffalo dairy, maybe Anne Saxelby knows more about this than I do, there is a buffalo dairy in Vermont, and there might be one or two in California, where they have figured out how to make the animals happy without tropical conditions. Do you know anything?
The only one that I knew of was the Woodstock Water Buffalo Company, which I think has changed names since then. But I had never drank buffalo milk, but I had the buffalo yogurt, which was just incredible. It was like, you know, eating clotted cream, basically. It was so rich and delicious. Uh-huh. I would imagine that the milk would be really, really fine.
They give extremely rich milk. The only dairy animal that gives richer milk is a sheep, and a sheep gives, you know, like maybe a quart or two a day. And water buffaloes can give gallons a day, and it's very rich. It's rich in butterfat, which is the thing that really gives milk flavor. And I think that probably there's going to be more experiments with water buffaloes in this country, but it isn't happening on a big scale yet.
Well, it sounds like a dairyman or cheesemaker's dream to have gallons of milk with that high butterfat versus quarts. Because, yeah, sheep milk is great, too, but it is a hot commodity. Sheep produce very little milk, so...
Yeah, I actually had a question about that. Are there other animals besides sheep and goat and buffalo and cows that people drink the milk out of?
Yes. Where milking evolved, they pretty much used the milk of any ruminant or thing, kind of like a ruminant, that gave milk.
Can you explain camels? Ruminant really quick, just for our listeners? I don't know if everyone knows what a ruminant is.
I know.
Well, ruminants ruminate. That is, they eat grass, grass, maybe leaves, and they chew the cud. That is, they swallow the grass. The grass goes down into this complicated system of stomachs. The grass comes up again from the first stomach as cud. The cow eats as much as she can, any other animal, the goat, the sheep, the whatever. You have to really be serious about eating grass to get enough of it to give you energy for the day. So you swallow it as fast as you can. Then you regurgitate it as cud. You swallow it. You chew it and chew it and chew it and chew it. And eventually you swallow it again, and it goes down into this complicated system of stomachs that breaks down the cellulose, the fiber, in the grasses that we people could not digest. As it progresses through this, I guess it's four-chambered arrangement of stomachs, gradually it's broken down to a form where it can be absorbed into the cow's bloodstream, and where it's a food that we could digest, where we're unable to digest the original grass.
Okay, so we were talking about different kinds of milk. So there's a cow, sheep, goat, buffalo, like mm-hmm. we said.
And camels. Which are not exactly ruminants because they don't have the four-chambered stomach, but they do kind of the same thing with a three-chambered stomach.
Wow. That's very, very interesting.
There are horses. There are donkeys. And these are not ruminants, but they also have the capacity to digest grass. And all of these, people just routinely used the milk of all of these in the Middle East, the Silk Road, all those parts of the world where the most interesting milk culinary traditions arose.
Interesting. Can you just maybe name a couple of different recipes in your book that would that might have been used at one time with those types of milk?
Well, I have, if I do say so myself, I have fairly clear directions for making yogurt at home. And you could have made yogurt from any of those. From some of them, you could have churned butter also, the buffalo and the cow and probably the sheep. I've left out one animal which didn't come from that part of the world, but it's said to give really great milk, and people are experimenting with it also in this country. It's yaks, Tibetan yaks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you can't make yogurt with milk from, like, a human?
I don't know whether anybody's trying. it would be really, really different because human milk has an awful lot more lactose, more milk sugar, than that from cows or these other animals.
Uh-huh.
I know. Well, horse's milk has a lot of lactose. Yeah, what happens when you have the lactose is you have an alcoholic, it tends to make an alcoholic fermentation, not just this lactic acid bacteria fermentation that turns the milk sour, but one, a carbon dioxide fermentation that actually ends up with a certain amount of alcohol.
Oh.
And people in Silk Road countries, especially the ones that used horses, you know, mare's milk, they made a lot of this kumis, which is part sour and part effervescent. I have not ever had kumis, the real thing from mare's milk. People say that you either love it or hate it.
Well, I just one quick aside. There's a beer company in Japan called the Hitachino Beer Company, and they make a lactose stout. So that makes sense now that you say that lactose readily ferments, that they would try that as a beer-making ingredient.
Do you know what it's like?
It's delicious. Oh, anyone who hasn't tried it, yeah, it's the lactose stout from the Hitachino Beer Company. They've got this great little owl on the label. It's tough to miss. But I'm getting a sign. I think we have another caller on the line.
And this is your father calling from Chicago.
Hi, Dad. How are you?
I am fascinated by this, and I'd like to ask Anne a question, which is what has led her to spend as much time as she has studying this whole topic of milk. I'm fascinated by this.
Well, it's partly that I always liked those critters when I was a kid, and I'm glad that I grew up in farms where they were visible just down the road every day. When I moved away from that part of Pennsylvania, I found that, you know, other people don't live like that. And other people don't really seem to know that milk originally came from an animal instead of a supermarket. And as the years went on, I felt as if the milk, the stuff that was being offered to us to drink under the name of milk, was getting more and more unreal. And after a certain amount of unreality had gone by, I thought, hey, things are maybe turning around a little, because there were starting to be small dairies, like within the last 10, 15 or so years, where they treat the cows well, where they're not trying to factory farm. There are these small dairies with maybe Jersey cows or some other breed that you don't see all the time, where they care about the quality of the milk. And to me, it was just like, hallelujah, what took them so long? And I think that is worth pointing out, because I'm not the only person who would like to be able to buy really good milk.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that is that's a great point. I think for myself, and I don't know about you, Heather, but I grew up drinking milk from a supermarket as well.
Yeah, me too.
So
lots of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk again a little bit about milk in New York City and wrap up our talk with Ann Mendelsohn, author of Milk, The Surprising Story of Milk Through the Ages.
I just want to know about your different lives. I heard some people fun. I heard some you got your families living in cages, tall and cold. Some just stay there and dust away past the age of old. Is this true? Please let me talk to you. I just want to know about the rooms behind your minds. Do I see a vacuum there, or am I growing blind? Or is it just a remains for vibrations?
Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. This is Cutting the Curd. My name is Anne Saxelby. My co-host is Heather Box, and our guest today is Anne Mendelsohn. So getting back to this topic of real milk and what real milk tastes like, there's a lot of debate, and there are a lot of options out there right now for people to buy different kinds of milk. You hear about people going to supermarkets and there's organic milk and there's grass-fed milk and there's hormone-free milk and all these different kind of confusing labels. And I think one of the best parts of your book is that you never take a stance. You allow for the fact that there's a lot of gray in this new kind of farmscape that we're encountering. It's not just good or bad or big agribusiness or small backyard cow. Is there any advice that you can offer to people out there about choosing a good source of milk?
I would, as much as possible, and obviously this depends where you live, but as much as possible, I would look for milk from small dairies in your own part of the country. They really do exist more than they used to. It's happening it's been happening in New England for a while. It's happening in New York State. It's happening in many of the northeastern states. And even the Midwest that used to be totally just these mammoth dairies, there is starting to be a lot of small-scale dairying. And people are bottling milk in real bottles. They're selling it often unhomogenized, which tastes wonderful. I don't know. Well, Anne, maybe you can say what the difference to you is between tasting homogenized and unhomogenized milk.
Oh, unhomogenized is hands down, yeah, superior. I didn't really know, not having grown up in going to supermarkets and having most of my food from there. It's been sort of a steep learning curve for me, you know, a little bit later in life, figuring all this stuff out. And I remember one of the first cheese places I went to visit was the Tamales Bay. It was in Tamales Bay. It was the Point Reyes Cheese Company. And I didn't know what homogenization was at all. Mm-hmm. And I asked, because, you know, you hear these words, homogenization, pasteurization.
Right.
And I just get, you know, I was getting them all confused. And so pasteurization I had gotten down. That was the heating up of the milk to kill the bacteria. But homogenization was always a little bit more sort of mysterious to me because I had never seen unhomogenized milk. So basically, homogenization is the process by which the milk is kind of put through a centrifuge and the fat globules in the milk are broken up so that they're the same size as the water molecules. And what that means is the milk does not separate into cream and skim. The milk stays intact as just, you know, a sort of uniform white fluid, which, you know, was mainly done for cosmetic reasons. Unhomogenized milk that has that cream in it is just unbelievably rich and delicious and sort of, you know, like a milkshake all on its own.
Yeah, and even if it has the same total percentage of butterfat as the whole milk in the supermarket, you know, the regular homogenized stuff, it has a creamier feeling as you take a mouthful and swallow it because you have that contrast of the creamy part that hasn't just been reduced to one uniform whole. The contrast of the creamy part with the leaner part. It's as if you can taste these two different effects at once.
Absolutely.
What does it mean, like, for Anne and I who grew up just drinking whatever milk from wherever store, what does it mean, what's the advantage of drinking, besides that it tastes better and it's richer, and are there, like, reasons to drink, you know, milk from small farms and unhomogenized?
Well, I think that it is a good thing on the whole to encourage small dairies, small farms and small dairies. I think that it would be almost impossible to overstate how difficult a dairy farmer's life is, especially the ones who produce milk for very, very large co-ops or very large dairies. They operate on just these cruelly thin profit margins. If you're an independent small farmer with your own small dairy or connected with a local small dairy, you have a little more financial leeway because people are willing to pay a somewhat higher price I really should point out that in this country we have incredibly cheap milk. Every time the price goes up 10 cents a gallon, consumers scream. And I feel some sympathy for that, but at the same time, it's unrealistic to expect good-tasting milk to be produced as cheaply as most of it is.
I think that's an excellent point, and it also brings it back to what you were talking about, growing up with this landscape of farms, supporting this kind, trying to seek out these kinds of milk producers also means that you're supporting a working landscape and a farming landscape in a country that's becoming less and less of a farming country. In general, though, there are these pockets, as Anne said, of kind of, you know, little revivals, be it dairy or other small specialty farming. Well, thank you so much, Anne, for coming and being on the show. Unfortunately, we run out of time for the day, but we look forward. Again, the title of Anne's book is Milk, The Surprising Story of Milk Through the Ages. And it's Anne Mendelsohn. And if you get a chance to pick up a copy of this book, definitely do. It's a fascinating historical chronicle as well as an enticing cookbook. Who doesn't want to learn how to make their own yogurt? So thanks to everybody, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks.